Today's podcast is brought to you by Every Wednesday, a plan to inspire the people of Portland and support the place we call home. Let's get out of the house and spend some time with each other. Skip Zoom, meet for coffee, take your colleagues out to happy hour. Buying a gift? Ditch the internet and support a local maker by shopping in-store. Head into town every Wednesday and see what's going on at everywednesdaypdx.com.
Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
Happy belated 420, y'all. I'm back. And what an issue to come back to. As Willamette Week's faithful Potlander columnist, the 420 issue is one that I look forward to all year. And I was really excited to be a part of this package. This year's theme is the Stoner Age. And the through line is the ubiquity of cannabis. It's at Airbnbs, it's down wellness aisles, it's driving nonprofits and business incubators. Its ancillary industry is super diverse. And there's so much weed that it's practically free. However, at this moment, Oregon's cannabis industry is also facing both a severe lack of retail accountability and a newly instituted testing regimen that could decimate the very basis of our much admired cannabis culture. Ooh, am I gonna need bong hits for this? I might need bong hits for this. It's Saturday, April 22nd, and this is episode 120 of The Dive. On this week's episode, I'm welcoming two guests. First, I'll talk to Sophie Peel, whose piece on Aspergillus fungus and its potential to cripple our sun-grown organic cannabis market is a fascinating and frustrating look at the disconnect between farms and regulators. Then I'll talk to cannabis advocate and artist Amy Zimmerman, who makes a 420 advent calendar every year. We'll talk about how she sourced 20 different cannabis artists, makers, and unique brands to complete her calendar countdown. And we'll get into all of that in just one sec. But first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. A number of Republican leaders are demanding Governor Kotek hire an outside counsel to probe the OLCC's relationship with La Mota. The dispensary chain whose tax liens and legal troubles were covered by Sophie Peel in last month's bombshell cover, Strange Budfellows. The OLCC kept giving licenses to La Mota despite their financial issues, and Kotek's campaign received over $70,000 from a political action committee controlled by a La Mota founder. Kotek has yet to respond. Lucas Manfield reports that Brian Hunziker, the former head of the Portland Police Union, who was fired from the Bureau for leaking a false report on vocal critic of the PPB, then Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. He was then rehired because an arbitrator deemed it so, but has now resigned after being exposed moonlighting for Clark County's sheriff's office. FYI, many of our local PPB officers do not live in the city they patrol. Wow, I wonder how that affects the way in which they police this city. In food and drink, reporter Jamie Ketench brings us Chef Elsie Dinville's Creole Me Up, marinades, cooking vinegars, and spicy Haitian slaw. A lineup inspired by Dinville's Haitian upbringing. Portland, you know you need spice. Creole Me Up is available in markets citywide. All right, now let's chat with my first guest, Sophie Peel. What is this fungus that the Oregon Health Authority just dropped new cannabis testing rules about?
So the fungus is called Aspergillus. And it is a very ubiquitous fungus. I mean, pretty much every single person breathes it in some capacity every single day. It's just, it's in pretty much every single environment. And it especially festers and grows on decomposing organic matter. So like on compost piles, there's a whole lot of Aspergillus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there have been some cases and that have not involved cannabis, to my knowledge, where people who are severely immunocompromised or if they already have a respiratory illness, if they inhale, you know, a certain amount of Aspergillus, they can become very ill with it. Mm. Again, when, you know, we had asked the Oregon Health Authority, have there been any cases connected to cannabis inhalation? They said no. Despite that, they started implementing testing for Aspergillus on March 1st. And it's particularly concerning, it sounds like, and a lot of the evidence so far is somewhat anecdotal. We have early testing results from the OLCC, but you know, it's sort of a small sample size because it just was implemented about a month and a half ago. But anecdotal evidence from the weed industry, and especially organic farmers, is that this type of test is really going to impact farmers who, you know, don't spray their weed with really harsh chemicals that strip all this, you know, all these different types of fungi, including Aspergillus, off. So organic farmers are anecdotally saying our weed and products are being more impacted by this because Aspergillus is everywhere. We don't kill it during our process. We have, we sort of do this whole ecology system where we try to nurture the plant with as many, you know, things, as natural things as possible, including Aspergillus. So, yeah.
Is Aspergillus, is that some kind of like, does it have some kind of mutually beneficial relationship with the cannabis?
That's a good question. I don't think it's inherently like helpful to the cannabis. I just think it's just integrated into the organic process. Like it's an organic matter, it's an organic fungus. It especially festers on decomposing, you know, vegetation. A lot of organic farmers will use compost to grow their weed because mm-hmm. it's supposed to create better weed. Mm-hmm. I talked to one farmer who uses what he calls a compost tea to spray his weed with, mm-hmm. which I've never heard of before, but I loved that concept. So I don't know if it inherently is like helpful to the weed, but it is part of a larger process that just kind of, I don't know, honors is kind of a tacky word, but I don't know, honors the organicness of the weed.
Totally. That is
the opinion, right? It's a very annoying thing to say, but I said it.
So for, 8 years ago, the health authority didn't care about this or said that it wasn't an issue. Why are they pivoting now?
It's a little unclear. I think there is speculation out there, and I think there, the Oregon Health Authority has confirmed this to some extent, is that a lot of other states that have legalized recreational cannabis have also implemented Aspergillus testing in the past couple years. And so Oregon has sort of been known to follow suit with Colorado, with California, sort of the trailblazing states. Yeah. So I think in a lot of ways, they're just looking at what other states are doing and saying, okay, if they're doing it, it's probably pretty legitimate. We should probably do this as well, mm-hmm. especially as, you know, of course, we don't know when recreational weed will be legalized federally, but once that does happen, whether it's in 5, 10, 15 years, there probably is going to be some sort of standardized tests that have to be implemented. And so I think Oregon's thinking in this is partly, you know, let's get to a place where when federal legalization does happen, we're not in this, you know, we're not shocked by all these new testing requirements that we, so sort of like titrating up almost a little bit.
Mm-hmm. No, I get that. That makes sense. So I'm wondering if this is particular because sure, we would want to follow suit with all of the other recreational states, but our growing environment is not the same as all the other states. So I'm wondering if this fungus is more around in Oregon because it's so wet here.
I don't know if Washington actually has Aspergillus testing. I know that Colorado and California do, but also what's interesting, and there's sort of some disagreement about how California's Aspergillus testing differs from Oregon's Aspergillus testing, but one of the main gripes that the weed industry here has with OHA's new testing rules is they're not looking like, the test just merely looks for the presence of Aspergillus DNA. So apparently it doesn't distinguish between live or dead Aspergillus. And then two, it you know, you don't have to reach a certain threshold of Aspergillus, a certain colony count, they call it, mm-hmm. in order for your product or your weed to be ineligible for retail sale. Mm-hmm. It's just whether there's a presence of it. So if it's detected, you know, your product's sort of a goner.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's wild. So this could, like, decimate certain farms? Like, it could really affect? Is this going to take companies out?
Well, I think it might be too early to say. You know, we're a month and a half into these tests. And, you know, the big harvest is in the fall. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to be the real litmus test for whether this could tank the industry. But preliminary results from testing is, you know, I think is really concerning the industry. The latest tests since March 1st show that 22% of infused pre-rolls failed Aspergillus tests, and then 6% of flower failed, which 6% I realize doesn't sound like a lot, but like it's pretty high rate.
Yeah.
When that rate was basically like, you know, non-existent prior.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting because the weed industry, you know, the big sort of industry guild over the past three Fridays has held a meeting every single Friday over the past 3 weeks to talk about Aspergillus. And I listened in on it last week. And I mean, organic farmers are really panicking. I mean, yeah. There were a lot of sort of doomsday stories of like, it will, if one harvest fails this Aspergillus test, I'm gone. I'm mm-hmm. decimated.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think it's too early to say. But I think people are really, really, and rightly concerned.
Mm-hmm. People who understand the fungus and the effects of the fungus, what do they have to say about this? Like, what? You mentioned that there's anecdotal evidence that someone who's highly immunocompromised, that it could adversely affect their health. But like, what big picture, like how would this affect like the average smoker?
I talked to one farmer who sort of used this anecdote to explain it. He said, smoking's also not for everyone. If you are severely immunocompromised, if you already have an inhalation illness or a respiratory illness, you don't smoke.
Yeah.
And that's a personal decision that you and your doctor have to make. And you know, you put warning labels on tobacco and cigarette products saying don't smoke it if X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so OHA is sort of making these testing rules to cater to the very, very, very few people mm-hmm. who have respiratory illness or are severely immunocompromised who also decide to smoke weed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's kind of this sense of unfairness from the weed industry, which they felt for a long time. I mean, we continue to pile on regulations for cannabis, you know, the cannabis industry. It's interesting because I feel like in some ways we really pile on regulations and then in other ways we just sort of, we completely abdicate our responsibilities, but that's a different subject. So I think, you know, this farmer was saying if you're immunocompromised and you've got a respiratory illness, you should not be smoking cannabis. You should not be inhaling, you know, anything, yeah. let alone Aspergillus. And that's just how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a personal responsibility thing. And it's really interesting because there have been like, you know, the big lawsuits over tobacco products and cigarettes have been about how does personal responsibility and accountability like factor into your decision to smoke? Is it the tobacco company's fault for, you know, like allowing this product to happen? Like mm-hmm. how much of your decision to smoke a cigarette should be on you versus the company you're buying it from? So it sort of gets into a larger, I think, philosophical realm.
Oh, really? Yeah. I had a crazy thought when I was reading the story. The first thing that came to my mind was, oh my gosh, somebody at OHA has like a side hustle, or maybe their nephew just opened a business that tests for this specific thing, right? Because it just didn't, like, if it's ubiquitous, it really does seem like, why are we still piling on to the cannabis industry?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah. It's interesting too. I think another layer of concern for farmers is there's very few ways, if you test positive for Aspergillus, to remediate that and to mm-hmm. get rid of it. And there's two ways, and sort of the only one that seems all that available is this sort of this machine that basically like kills the live Aspergillus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very expensive. There's like one company right now that I think has that machine, and they apparently just brought one to Eugene to try to test it out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like remediation services are readily available and affordable. You know, it's not just like a nuisance of it's going to take another week. These are hard to find and they're really expensive. And, you know, you're asking farmers who are already operating on a very, very slim profit margin, if a profit margin at all, if they're not already in the negative, to spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to remediate their weed of something that many of them would argue isn't dangerous to 99.9% of consumers.
Now, when the OHA was putting this together, were they doing this hand in hand with farmers? Were they getting the input, or were they just kind of
not that I know of? I mean, there have been, you know, the OHA oftentimes has work groups that are that consist of, you know, scientists and industry guild people and technical experts and rule makers and legislators and all that. I think it's a little, I think what farmers will say and what the industry will say is that this process to them felt really cloaked. And
yeah, totally.
They weren't, they say that they weren't involved. No one really wanted this in the industry. And they feel like the OHA has sort of just watched what other states have done and sort of sloppily said, hey, we're going to do the same thing, but have not kind of honed or crafted the tests in a way that like is sort of comparable to what other states have done and how they've taken precautions over colony counts and that sort of thing. So I think they felt like it was a little, you know, slapdash.
Yeah, it's very that. It does feel very that.
Now let's chat with local artist and cannabis advocate Amy Zimmerman about her 420 Advent calendar.
How do you source all of the different products that you're going to put in the calendar?
Well, I actually, I get on social media and I am really interested in finding as many people in the industry as I can that are underrepresented. I'm very interested in newer businesses and seeing how people are breaking into this industry and seeing new ideas that people are coming up with. So, you know, even just randomly, I'll see somebody using a piece on their feed and, you know, see that it's a beautiful piece. If they don't post in their feed, you know, where it came from or whatever, I will reach out and contact them.
You're gonna slide into those DMs.
And then I'm going to look and I'm going to see what that company's about. So some of the things that I love, like Oak and Earth Creations was a great one. They are a, they come out of both Arizona and Canada. There's a no plastics company. So there's no plastics involved in any way, shape, or form. They are a ceramic smoking piece. They're beautiful. The wood, they also do like a wood cuff on some of the pieces, and that's reclaimed wood. And then for every piece sold, 5 trees are planted.
So
like, I'm looking for these things. I'm looking for not only beauty and innovation and something that people want to use and have around. But on top of that, I really like seeing that there is a soul behind it and that there is purpose behind it. 40 Goods is another great one. They make furniture like credenzas that lock.
Is this like a little bit of a stash box vibe? It's like a designer furniture stash box vibe?
Yeah, but it's like an end table. But this is a great company. They are using, you know, sustainable resources for their products. It's also a women-founded and women-run company. And a lot of their money is going back into the community as well. And I feel like that's, you know, it's really important to, especially in a new industry, you need to set a standard of pushing... It sounds so snooty. Pushing a proper agenda. Let's push a proper agenda, shall we? Like, I don't know. Just, get your head about you. And let's, like, try to find some things that are representing the underrepresented. That, you know, let's find some ways in a new industry to actually lift up the people that we're constantly saying that we want to fight for. And if we're not able to within old standards... how about we create new standards within a new industry? Create, you know, a new path and make availability a standard rather than a slight option.
Right.
And you know, really search out and find the companies that are women owned, that are Black and Brown owned, that are, you know, being run in a sustainable manner. Let's uplift in this huge, like, incredible rush of businesses that are coming at us. You know, in a few years, half of them are still going to exist. Yeah. Let's make sure that it's the ones that should be existing.
Right.
Thanks to this week's guests, Sophie Peel and Amy Zimmerman. And thanks also to Anthony Effinger for hosting in my absence. All right, I'll talk to y'all next week. Bye.